We've already had glimpses of Samson's supernatural strength. You might remember he killed the lion with his bare hands. He turned the tables on those gloating Philistines by slaughtering 30 of their leading men and taking those valuable garments to pay off that debt where they had sort of tricked him in that riddle that he had put before them. But now, in this chapter 15, his supernatural strength becomes the focal point as there's instance upon instance where God shows himself strong and the Spirit of the Lord comes upon Samson in a mighty way. And so we're going to see that in this cycle of retaliation between Samson and the Philistines, where you did this to me, so I'm doing this to you. Okay, well, you did that to us, so we're going to do this to you. And it just goes back and forth, and yet the dominant stream, I think, is for us to see this supernatural strength that the Lord gives to Israel's deliverer. He has anointed Samson to be Israel's deliverer, to bring about the beginning of deliverance from the oppression of the Philistines. And so the Lord is going to show himself strong. He's going to show this supernatural strength which allows Samson to emerge victorious in this cycle of retaliation with these, I'm calling them the conniving, uncircumcised Philistines. They're conniving. They're always trying to get one up on Samson. You know, Samson's got a lot of brilliance in different ways. He's got brilliance in how he uses words and riddles and poetry and how he expresses things. And he's got different ways that he comes up with strategies as to how he's going to attack the Philistines. But the Philistines, they've got their own conniving, treacherous approach towards how they deal with things. And there's this battle going back and forth, this opposition, which the Lord is behind the scenes orchestrating. Because remember from last week, the Lord wants to stir up this enmity between the two factions because he doesn't want his people, the Israelites, to remain complacent in worldliness, to remain embracing the culture and the value system of these uncircumcised Philistines. He wants to drive a wedge between them and show the distinction. And so it's a war between value systems. It's a war between gods, the God of the Philistines and God, Jehovah God. It's a war between religions that's taking place. And God is using Samson in this. We saw in chapter 13, remember the bright beginning of Samson and how the announcement of his birth and the fact that God had put his mark even from the womb upon Samson, the Nazarite vow that was taken and all that the angel of the Lord had proclaimed there in terms of the great prospects for all the expectations we had that this individual that was going to come on the scene was going to be used by God in a mighty fashion. So we had all this buildup in chapter 13. And then in chapter 14, we were really let down to some extent when we saw the fatal flaw of Samson, that he's only concerned, it seems, really about himself. He doesn't seem to have much of a vision for what his mission is from God. He seems all wrapped up in his own lust and his own desire to be self-indulgent and to satisfy his own appetites. And he seems all caught up in that. And now in chapter 15, we'll see the emphasis on supernatural strength. And then next week, in chapter 16, we'll see that tremendous final feat that God uses Samson to accomplish in this struggle with the Philistines. But Samson, he's an unusual, solitary figure. You don't see Samson marshaling the troops of God. You don't see the Israelites gathering behind Samson and him leading them into battle. In fact, in this passage, we're going to see 3,000 troops amassed against Samson. We're going to see the Israelites, how as it plays out, they actually are trying to fulfill the Philistines' objectives instead of the objectives of God here. And so it's a unique situation that Samson is in. He's not one that teaches us anything about the strength of fellowship, the strength of unity of God's people, of leadership and how you marshal God's troops and get them to accomplish God's objectives. You don't see a lot of those. We studied Nehemiah. Look at all that we learned from the life of Nehemiah about leadership. You don't see any of those traits reflected in the life of this solitary figure, Samson. Everybody turns against Samson. You have the Philistines as a nation turning against him. You have his father-in-law as he goes to take this bride whom he shouldn't be taking a bride from the Philistines. But as he goes to take this bride, the Timnite, the father-in-law, he turns against Samson in this instance. And then even the Israelites, as we've said, they're going to bind Samson and deliver him over to the enemy. So there's nobody really that's on Samson's side. But we can't forget that the Lord has anointed him to be his servant. And at the end of this passage, we saw how Samson acknowledges that you know, this deliverance was accomplished by your strength, by you using your servant, you know, in this instance. This is one of the few times that we see Samson having any Godward thoughts, where he's putting it in any type of frame of reference that shows what God is doing behind the scenes. I mean, his thinking seems to be all wrapped up around himself until you see that final paragraph here in chapter 15. Even when Samson is acting, though, from his mixed motives, you know, he's acting from motives of revenge and from retaliation, we understand that the Lord is providentially using that situation to motivate Samson to actually be his servant of judgment against God's enemies, against the Philistines. So in that sense, his actions are justifiable and commendable in some of the slaughter that takes place, which seems in one sense horrific maybe, but it's justified when we see that it's against God's enemies and that God is behind the scenes using Samson as his servant. And that's why Samson is listed in Hebrews 11 in that hall of faith. Spurgeon, he had this quote about Samson. He said, his whole life is a series of miracles and follies. It's just this contrasting muddle, this picture that's hard to make sense out of between God and the Holy Spirit coming upon him in a supernatural fashion to do miracles. Whom would God use to do those types of things? And yet he's using an individual that is a weak person morally and has all types of issues in himself. So he's not a very likable figure, I don't think, Samson. He's a figure that's yet heroic. He stands out because of his great supernatural strength, but it's the dependence upon God. He's coming to an awareness through these different incidents. Samson's coming to an awareness that God is using him and that he can function as a servant of God. And it's amazing how God uses someone with so much sin and impurity in his life. So the Lord here, he anoints Israel's deliverer Samson with supernatural strength in order that he would emerge victorious in this cycle of retaliation with the conniving, uncircumcised Philistine. Verses 1 to 3, we're going to see the provocation that arouses God's anointed deliverer to action. What makes Samson, again, take action? We saw at the end of chapter 14 that Samson was sort of finished with things. He'd had that spat over the riddle. He'd been frustrated with the fact that the Philistines had plowed with his own heifer and had tricked him in the sense of winning that bet. And so he delivered on the bet, and he went and had slain those 30 Philistines, and then he'd stalked off to his home in sort of sulking fashion, where he's angry and he's bitter against the Philistines, and he's angry and bitter against his father-in-law, and especially his wife, who's been turned against him to be disloyal, to be used by the Philistines. Of course, she was under great threat of being burned, and yet he was angry. So now we see what was used by God to stir Samson back up to action. It's this aspect of provocation. In verse 1, we see Samson finally has gotten over things a little bit. You know how it is with us guys. You know, we boil over and we get upset about stuff, and then we stew about it a little bit, and then we're quiet and we get people to silent treatment and then whatever. And then finally, you know, it all works out, and finally, you know, he sort of comes to his senses here. He calms down, and it says in verse 1, after a while, I don't know how long it took him, but in the time of the wheat harvest, Samson visited his wife with a young goat and said, I will go into my wife in her room. So he's got joyful intentions here. He certainly has expectations that he can sort of come back and pick up just as if nothing had ever happened, it seems. Like he expects he's just going to be able to walk in there, and he takes his box of chocolates and his flowers, you know, with him. You know, in this sense, it's a young goat. So, you know, that's, I guess, something that in those days was accepted as a nice little present gift to bring with you. So he comes bearing gifts. He's cooled down, but what hasn't cooled down is his passion for this young bride. And it's questionable here as to whether the marriage had actually been consummated. During that seven-day marriage feast, I mean, did he and his wife get together on the first day, or were they waiting? Given the self-indulgence of Samson, it's hard for me to imagine that he's getting drunk and he's going through this feasting time and he's going to wait 7 days. So I don't know. Most commentators seem to think that, oh, maybe this marriage had never even been consummated. I'm kind of the opinion that maybe it already had, but it had appeared to the father. The way Samson had left things, it had appeared that, hey, this wasn't going to be renewed. And of course, the father, with his obligation to see that his older daughter now be taken care of in terms of marriage before his younger daughter, his father, we're going to see, had given this bride away. But look at Samson's approach here in verse 1. To me, his attitude, his tone is very demanding. You know, you would think he would come back somewhat conciliatory, you know, and for reconciliation. But that's not Samson. Again, Samson's not one to be contrite. He's not one to come across with a sense of meekness. And he comes across very demanding. I want what's mine. You know, he's arrogant. He's possessive, as if this bride is his and he has every right to this. And so he comes in this type of a tone. I think it must have been very terrifying for the father of this woman. And yet the father stands up to him, we see in the end of verse 1. It says, but her father did not let him enter. I mean, he wants to come in for the purpose of having relations with this woman, and that he views as his wife. He calls her his wife, thinks that this is something that's already been concluded, that matter has been addressed, and he just wants to enjoy relations with her. And the father says, whoa, calm down, Samson. This isn't going to happen the way that you planned it out. And so I think it's quite something on the part of the father. Maybe the girl isn't in the house there. Maybe she's in the house of the husband now. I don't know if the daughter was actually in the house or not. But the father gives the explanation here, and he says, you know, we're going to have to consider plan B, you know, because I thought you hated her. The way you didn't communicate when you took off, you left things just completely broken off. You know, we basically annulled that marriage. We basically canceled that one off and said, hey, that's not going to happen, and we moved on to plan B. You need to move on to plan B. In fact, let me design something. I mean, he was aware of Samson's strength, and he was certainly, I think, shaking in his boots a little bit, and he's on the spot trying to come up with something that he thinks would placate Samson here. It's amazing the things that these dads come up with. But he suggests here, well, let's do this. In fact, he says, well, I got to tell you what happened. I gave her to your best man, you know. Oh, great. You know, so my best man, looking out for my interest there, you know, he went and took the wife. You know, so that's the kind of loyalty there was to Samson. Samson never had anybody that was really loyal to him, and he didn't engender that type of relationship. And so I guess it's his best man, in a sense, that had been granted the wife here. So the father says, well, let's try this. How about her younger sister? In fact, she's more beautiful. I doubt if she's more beautiful. I mean, Samson had his choice. He picked out the one that struck his fancy, so I imagine that he was more taken with the older daughter than the younger one. But the dad tries to package things up as nice as he can and says, well, the younger daughter, you know, she's got the same genes, and in fact, she's younger, and she's more attractive. Please let her be yours instead. So the father's hoping that will solve this issue, which is certainly a very tense situation. He has no idea how Samson's going to respond. He's seen responses before. He knows how volatile, how impulsive. He knows, you know, just how strong Samson is. And what he offers here, of course, especially if Samson was actually married to the older daughter, I mean, the Mosaic law from Leviticus 18, verse 18, it says it's against the law of God to then, you can't marry the one daughter and then marry the sister. You know, that would not be legitimate. I don't know if Samson cared about that at all. I think Samson just cared about, hey, I want the other one, and I feel like I've been done wrong here. I feel like, you know, I'm due this, and you guys have jilted me in a sense that's unjust. And so he didn't like this plan B, he didn't like this reversal. And so he expresses himself in verse 3 with this sense of justified retaliation. You know, he said there might have been some question in people's minds about whether it was legitimate for me to go kill the 30 men to pay off the debt. Well, maybe that was a little questionable, you know. I mean, maybe that's a little hard for me to justify in a court of law and to stand up and say, hey, I was really righteous in doing that. But in this case, he said, oh, there's not going to be any question. I'm the one that's been wrong. So he said, this time, I shall be blameless in regard to the Philistines when I do them harm. He uses this generic, vague expression. So you wonder, again, the excitement is building up in this narrative as you are going forward wondering, wow, what is going to be this harm? What's going to be the content of this calamity that Samson's going to bring upon the Philistines? Remember, it's one man speaking as if he's against a nation. I mean, the contrast here, if you think about how the Philistines later on had their champion, Goliath, there's a lot of contrast between the Philistines and their champion, Goliath, and how David, little David, came out in trust and dependence upon the Lord with just that slingshot of the stones and came up against Goliath. You see, you know, a lot of contrast between the champion of the Philistines. And here, Samson is supposed to be the champion of the Israelites, but you don't see the Israelites standing behind him, cheering him on. You know, there's none of that. Samson is actually in their territory, even, and he's trying to make a stand. And there's this dialogue taking place, and there are these threats now that Samson is making, saying, you haven't seen anything yet. You thought, you know, you were mourning. They had 30 families mourning over the loss of their sons in this previous incident. Well, wait till you see what I do this time. It's going to be a lot more devastation than that. And apparently Samson, you know, he doesn't turn immediately upon the father and upon the daughter. He doesn't go to them and destroy them. He sees that the Philistines were the ones who had been behind preventing that marriage in the first place by disrupting that whole riddle scenario, turning his wife against him. He holds the Philistines responsible for that and says that his vengeance, his revenge, is going to be exacted against them. So ultimately, Samson, while he's about his own agenda, he's also, of course, fulfilling the Lord's agenda as he's provoked here into action. We're going to see that now God is going to use him and bestow his great power upon him in the incidents that take place. So in verses 4 to 8, we're going to see the power that's bestowed on God's anointed deliverer and how it wreaks devastation on the wicked. This devastation is going to be directed against their personal property, and then it's going to be directed against the very lives of the Philistines as there's this great slaughter that ensues. But in each instance, it's supernaturally, divinely, God's strength and power at work. It's not that Samson is a cut above other fellows in terms of, wow, he's really, you know, sort of the champion Olympian. You know, if you put him in whatever the strength contest was, wow, Samson is just the best of the best among men. That's not the case at all. Samson is in totally a different category. It's superhuman strength that's being exhibited in these exploits. It's not just the greatest that you can imagine among humans. So he's in a whole different category in terms of what he's doing here. So as he reacts now, and he's going to bring about this harm upon the Philistines, it says in verse 4 that Samson went out and he caught 300 foxes. Any of you ever tried to do that? If you have trouble in with your vegetation and you have animals attacking your plants, have you ever tried to catch one fox? You know? And it's interesting, the word that's used translated fox here, some people, most of the commentators actually say here, well, it must have been jackals. I mean, the word's a little bit different, but it must have been jackals because they tend to run in packs. And it would have been easier to corral, you know, 30 of those at a time. Well, I don't know if that's the case. God is showing here that he does the impossible. He's showing his supernatural strength. God says it's foxes. I don't know that I want to make it jackals. I don't even know anatomically the difference between a fox and a jackal. If one ran by, I wouldn't be able to tell the difference. But whether it's foxes or whether it's jackals, I think it's pretty tough for us humans to run down. You know, and maybe he's trapping them. Maybe he's got instruments that he's using to lure them into something and to trap. But he's got to corral them. He's got to contain them. And then he's got to take two of them at a time and tie their tails together. Well, I don't think they're really participating in a friendly way in that exercise. I don't think that's something that they're especially giving over to. I don't know if he has some kind of an apparatus where you can stick the head of one in something and clamp it down, and stick the head in another and clamp it down. I mean, it's interesting to just try and conjecture, how do you even do something like this? You know, we're not given details, but it happened. This isn't some myth. This is something that took place. Samson somehow had 300 of these foxes, and he's tying their tails, so he's got 150 pairs in which he's inserted a torch. Now, the torch isn't lit yet because he doesn't want them to take off to his ready. So he's got, it's like he stages 150 pairs of these, and then all of a sudden, in a hurry, he's got to light 150 of these torches and get out of the way and open the gates of whatever the pen he has that they're in, and he lets them loose out in the field. Of course, you can imagine the panic, the disorientation, the frenzy of these foxes. Of course, they're built low to the ground, so these torches are right down at ground level, and they're going around all. They could cover apparently a pretty wide geographical area, and you know, you try and put out a little brush fire here and brush fire that you had. I mean, it was just devastating. You had fires cropping up all over the place, and so the destruction happened. It said to the shocks, which is the harvested grain that had already been cut, as well as the standing grain, what was still growing in the fields. And it was directed against all of their main staples for their agricultural economy. In other words, their economy was built around grain, around grapes, around olive oil, but fruits of the vine. That's everything that was sustaining them. And here, it's all wiped out by animals. I mean, how? Samson doesn't have to get an army. He doesn't have to enlist all these men and get them loyal to him. He's able, individually, to use the animal kingdom and on his own to orchestrate all this devastation. So it's really amazing what Samson is able to accomplish here. But one commentator has an interesting idea. His name is James Jordan. He has very symbolic, allegorical kinds of interpretations to a lot of this life of Samson. A lot of the connections he makes to the ultimate deliverer, to the Messiah, and connections in that sense. He always has something that's very interesting, very thought out, but a little off the wall from, you know, what other people say. It's very interesting to consider. He says when Samson brings that baby goat, that kid, and he comes to the husband and to his bride-to-be, it says, when Samson is expressing a desire for a child, the kid of the goats is a regular symbol for a child. By bringing a kid, he was making his intentions known that he wanted to have a child. Well, I don't know if it was just a gift. That seems a little bit of a stretch to me to say that's what it is. But then he goes on. I thought this was interesting. He said, the Philistines, by wrecking his marriage, have prevented him from enjoying the seed, the child that would be lawfully his. So in response, he destroys their harvest, their you know, product of fruitfulness, their standing grain. They've ruined his harvest, he ruins theirs. And he's trying to make some rationale for why he picked this particular type of judgment to bring upon the Philistines. I don't know if there's any connection there or not. But it's interesting that this devastation of property was just all over the place. It was just so complete. So that verse 6, the Philistines, they said, who did this? You know, they're right away up in arms, trying to galvanize their troops to say, we got to go after somebody who did this. And of course, there's no secret. Samson can never keep any secret from the Philistines. I mean, they seem to always know what his activities are and what he's doing. And so people readily give him up and say, well, it was Samson. It was the son-in-law of the Timnite. Because he took his wife. See, she's referred to as his wife, both by the Philistines and by Samson. So it seems to me that there was that marriage that actually had taken place, and then it was done away with that after that point in time. So he took his wife and he gave her to his companion. So the Philistines, they now, it's their turn to respond. You have this tit for tat, this eye for an eye, this you do to me, I'll do to you, this evil for evil, you know, this violence breeds violence type of mentality on both the Philistines and Samson in this entire scenario of retaliation. So now the Philistines, they retaliate by coming up and burning the daughter and her father with fire. And that's pretty gruesome to think of being burned alive, you know, in the house and with their household there, being burned with fire. That's exactly the fate that she wanted to avoid in the first place. That's why she had turned on Samson. She said, well, I'm not going to have that happen to me. But God, in his providence, he brings about these things that we might try to escape, and we might try to think, well, I can escape by this, or I can do this. And yet God in his providence turns the tables here, and she ends up experiencing just what she had really tried to avoid. It seems like fire is their solution to everything. You know, whenever the Philistines, when they're confronted with something, their immediate answer is, well, burn them. You know, we're going to torture them. So that's what they do here. Commentator Block says, people may act as though they are masters of their own fate, but the hidden providence of God is able to bring the schemes and conduct of human beings upon their own heads, and thereby accomplish his own purposes. On the other hand, the Philistine rationalization sounds hollow. Needing a scapegoat, the Philistines may simply have concluded it was easier to deal with the Timnite than with Samson. In other words, why didn't they go after Samson right away? They find out, hey, the problem is Samson, and their response is they go burn the Timnite and his daughter. In their response, however, they underestimated Samson's commitment to his wife, his preparedness to retaliate, and his physical strength. And every time Samson acts, he always puts in the statement like, well, this will end it all. I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to go off, and that's the end of it. I'm doing this, that's the end of the story, that's the last word, and we're done. And of course, it never seems to work that way, because it's always he acts, and then they act. And the Philistines come up with a plan, and then Samson frustrates their plan and does something different. So there's always this retaliation backwards and forwards. And so in verses 7 and 8, Samson said to them, since you act like this, now since you've done this that I don't like, I will surely take revenge on you. That's what I've been doing all along, and now I'm going to do it. And it keeps escalating. The conflict, the violence, it keeps escalating and gets worse and worse. So he struck them ruthlessly. The Hebrew says, legon thon. He struck them legon thon. I don't know if it means he tore them limb from limb. I don't know if it could be a wrestling metaphor to mean like he just had the ultimate victory over them and he just completely dominated them. I don't know, but it's translated here as ruthlessly or as completely violent that he struck them. But the expression is legon thon. He struck them in some type of ferocious, ruthless attack with a great slaughter. Whatever a great slaughter is, I think that things are escalating. There's a crescendo that's building. Since he's going to kill 1,000 men in the later incident, I imagine this is somewhere less than 1,000 so that things can still build up. So it's more than 30 and it's less than 1,000, and it's somewhere in that framework that is defined as a great slaughter when you look at it as having been accomplished by one person, by the strength of the Lord, not by his own strength. So he understood that this action would cause the Philistines to come looking for him. So he had sort of a safe, secure hiding place. It says he went down and he lived in the cleft of the rock of Edom. So he had a cave situation up in the hills where he could hide out. And he goes and he takes refuge there, trying to say, well, sort of let that be it. Let that be done. But, of course, God has more in mind. I mean, God still wants to stir up that contention. He still knows that the Israelites as a people are still totally comfortable with the worldly situation in which they're living. And they're still networked in with the heathen, with the pagan uncircumcised Philistines. So in verses 9 to 17, we see the pursuit of God's anointed deliverer. He's pursued by both the Philistines and by his own countrymen, the Israelites. And it drives Samson once again to act alone in finally accomplishing his divine mission. So he's hunted down in verses 9 to 10 by the Philistines. The Philistines went up. They camped in Judah. They spread out in Lehi. The men of Judah said, why have you come up against us? What have we done? We said, we're innocent parties. The men of Judah are trying to stay out of this. They are as pacifist as you can be. They have no vision that God is raising up a deliverer whom they need to rally behind and support as their champion. That is nowhere in the thinking of the men of Judah. They want no part of this scrape. They want to distance themselves as much as possible. They are happy, even though they're under oppression by the Philistines. They boiled in that water to such an extent that they don't even realize what God's hopes and prospects for them are. They're willing to live a frustrated life of bondage as opposed to the freedom in which God has called them. You know, I think that's so much like so many believers today. So many believers have given up any kind of spiritual fight against sin, against trying to grow spiritually. They've said, okay, I'm a Christian. I want that free pass into heaven. I want that escape clause from hell. But when it comes to living a holy life, when it comes to being separate unto the Lord, when it comes to really living my life for the Lord, you know, maybe I've tried it, and it doesn't seem to work for me. I'm defeated. I don't seem to understand and identify with what the scriptures say about freedom from sin, freedom from bondage. I'm just going to have to be comfortable. I'm just going to give up. I'm just going to live my life as a friend of the world. And I'm just going to try to exist in this duplicitous situation where I'm wavering in my mind and I'm bouncing back between trying to be loyal to God, trying to have a relationship with the Lord, and yet recognizing that, yeah, I really cave in and I really am a friend of the world in many respects. I think this is the situation that many Christians in America find themselves in today. And God is not pleased with that situation. God wants to drive a wedge in there to say, wake up. There needs to be action taken so that we realize the spiritual warfare that we're in and we take sides and we're willing to engage the enemy and we're willing to fight for that freedom that God, by His grace, wants to give us. He wants to give us the gift of a life of victory. He wants us to live a fulfilled life of being yielding our members as instruments to righteousness rather than instruments to sin. This is what this is all about here. These men from Judah are all engulfed in this life of bondage, and they're comfortable with that. They've resigned themselves to that state. And so that's the side that they're on here. And so the Philistines, they say, we've come up to bind Samson in order to do to him as he did to us. That's the theme verse. You know, that expression runs throughout this whole chapter. I'm going to do to you as you did to me. Well, we're going to do to you as you did to me. We're going to do even worse to you than you did to me. And that's over and over again, this cycle of retaliation. And so it says in verse 11, you have 3,000 men of Judah. What an army. If this army could possibly be directed in a positive direction to accomplish something for God, but no, they've got no faith orientation. They've got no passion for being used as instruments of righteousness in God's camp. They've just completely given themselves over so that now they're going to do the will of the enemy. They're going to be instruments of Satan and say, what do you want us to do for you? We're at your disposal. What can I do for you? And so it says they went down. They knew where Samson was. They knew where he's hiding. They went down to the cleft of the rock of Eden. They lay it all on Samson, you know, and say, do you not know that the Philistines are rulers over us? Why aren't you accepting that? Why aren't you giving in to that? Samson's saying, I'm not giving in to that. He's the only one that's standing up against that fact of reality and saying, that's not the way things should be. Now, he might be doing it for impure motives. He might be not doing it in the purest sense. But at least he's taking a stand. These other men from Israel are saying, we're happy. We're resigned to the fact that they have bondage over us, and that's just the way it is. That's the way life is. How many times do you hear people say, well, that's just the way I am? I know what the scriptures say about what I should do, but that's just the way I am. It's too bad, but I can't change. That's the way. I mean, you don't know what I'm up against. You know, you don't have the personality I have. You don't have the limitations I have. That's the way I am. You know, and that's what these men of Judah said. No, the Lord said, that's not what I want. I'm going to use Samson to demonstrate that that's not the way life should be. And so they say, don't you know the Philistines are rulers over us? What then have you done to us? In other words, by attacking God's enemies, you put us in jeopardy. We don't want there to be any strife. We don't want to wake up the sleeping giant of Satan and his forces. We don't want there to be any conflict. We're just trying to live out our lives as peacefully as we can without anybody getting in our space and bothering us. We don't want to be a part of this. This is your conflict. This has nothing to do with us, the men of Judah said. And he said to them simply, as they did to me, so I've done to them. You know, not a very good rallying cry for a life of faith and a life of accomplishing God's mission. Again, God's working behind the scenes, but what he has to work with here in Samson is a pretty limited creature. So the men of Judah said, well, okay, here's the deal. We've come down. We have 3,000 of us because we figured this might be a difficult deal. I don't know why you would think 3,000. In other words, if 10 can't do it, okay, are 3,000 going to do it? I mean, it's supernatural strength. I don't care if you bring 3,000, 10,000. If 10 men can't do it, I don't think 3,000. But at least it gave them a little more security. They at least were willing to broach the topic. Now, they're not going in by force and just doing this. They're asking Samson's permission, essentially. You know, they're trying to get Samson's buy-in to this agenda because they realize even with 3,000 men, they're not just marching in there and laying the ropes on them and saying, hey, we're hog-tying you, that's it. No, they're saying, look, how about this? You know, let me suggest something here. They said, we've come down to bind you so that we may give you into the hands of the Philistines. And Samson, interestingly, Samson's response, it's possible that his concern here, when he says, swear that you're not going to try to kill me. I think his concern is, look, if you try to kill me, I'm going to have to rise up, and I'm going to have to kill you guys. You're my fellow countrymen. Even though you're essentially in the camp of the enemy and how you're responding here, I don't want to be put in a position where I'm going to be, the supernatural strength of God is going to be unleashed against you. Samson had an understanding of how God could work through him. And Samson says, look, he says, swear to me that, you know, you're not going to make an attempt on my life. If you do, it's going to get ugly, and I don't want to be put in that situation. So they said, no, he says, all we're going to do is, we're not going to kill you. We're just going to bind you, and we're going to hand you over to the Philistines. I don't know what's going to happen then. Who knows? You know, you might have a great life. You know? I don't think so. They know what's going to happen then. So they bound him with two new ropes. As if, now that makes the difference, you know? Now I got new ropes. So that'll really do it. And so they brought him up. So you can imagine this troop of 3,000 of God's people bringing their champion in tow in a humiliating fashion, bound with ropes, and now approaching the camp of the enemy. I mean, this is just so turned around. I mean, you can't help but think of the situation where Satan, in his plans, thinks, well, I'm going to use Judas. I'm going to use one of Jesus' own disciples to betray him, to hand him over to the enemy, to hand him over to the courts where we'll have trumped up charges, and we'll go ahead and we'll execute this one who is trying to be the master of the universe. And we have Satan's plans and Satan's agenda. And yet God's prophecy from the beginning, from the book of Genesis, had been, you know, when Christ is put to death on the cross, that'll just be a bruising of the heel is what that will be. But he will stomp you on the neck and kill the serpent. And that's what's happening here with respect to Samson in a very smaller sense, but in a typical fashion. The deliverer of God's people cannot be restrained by two new ropes. He cannot be contained by an army of 3,000 men, no matter what their agenda and their motives are. And so we see in verses 14 to 17 how Samson ends up being helped by the Holy Spirit as the Holy Spirit comes over him once more. So when he came to Lehi, the Philistines shouted as they met him. Look at the exaltation, the boasting. These uncircumcised Philistines are once again enjoying victory over the Jehovah God of the nation of Israel. What a disgrace upon God's name to see how excited these troops were that they think that they now have the victory. Well, the Spirit of the Lord had a different idea. It came upon him mightily so that the ropes that were on his arms were as flax that is burned with fire. His bonds dropped from his hands. I don't think they're shouting quite as heavily now, although they still seem to have the majority in terms of the troops. but they're not shouting as loud. So he reached out, he looks around, he looks for what kind of weapon can I use? I'm up against who knows how many troops. He kills 1,000, doesn't mean there weren't, 5,000 there, and the rest fled. But he's able to run down and kill 1,000. So he looks around, and he finds a weapon at hand, and it says, it describes it as a fresh jawbone of a donkey. Okay, he doesn't get the military assault rifle, or he doesn't get even the sword. He gets the fresh jawbone, fresh in the sense that he probably rips it out of a animal that's just died. Maybe he even killed the animal himself. Now, you got some problematic things in that you have that whole Nazarite vow where you're not supposed to touch a dead person or a dead carcass. And yet, when it comes to warfare, the Lord's blessing him to kill people. I mean, he's touching dead people in terms of the slaughter. So you've got some little ambivalence of what's going on there. But he grabs, if he had taken apparently an old jawbone that was brittle and that was, might not be able to withstand killing all these people, he's got something that's fresh and stronger than that. So he gets this fresh jawbone of the donkey. He reaches out, he took it, he killed 1,000 men. How do you kill 1,000 men with the jawbone of a donkey? You do it by the Spirit of God, is all you can say. I mean, I don't know how you even run down that many, but you can imagine the confusion, the terror, the people fleeing every direction. And here you have this heroic figure leaping, bounding all over the fields and corralling these guys and clubbing them to death with this jawbone. And then he has this, he combines this violent, macho, heroic kind of figure with this more poetic side that you don't expect to see, really, in someone like Samson. He's able to turn phrases and use words and expressions in even a poetic fashion. And so his song of triumph here is expressed in this pun, really. He's taking Hebrew words that look and sound alike and yet mean something different, and he's doing a play on words, because the Hebrew word for heap is just like the Hebrew word for ass or for donkey. And so he's using them in parallel fashion here, as he has this little expression. He says, with the jawbone of a donkey, heaps upon heaps, with the jawbone of a donkey I have killed 1,000 men. And it came about when he finished speaking, threw the jawbone from his hand. He didn't want that jawbone. Certainly, I don't know if that's part of the Nazarite thing of, hey, I shouldn't even be hanging on to this, or if it's part of, hey, this isn't going to become a religious relic. It's not going to become some kind of an idol where we carry around with us the famous jawbone, But anyway, he's piled up these carcasses. 1,000 carcasses. What a stench of them. And just a foul mess you've got there. But instead of some type of respectful burial, you think how important proper burial was back in those days. Burial is always recorded when you talk about the patriarchs and you go on and talk about the saints. It talks about their burial, how important it is. Well, here he piles up all these stinking dead carcasses in a heap. And so he calls that place Ramath Lahai. So it just means the Jawbone Hill. The high place of the jawbone, and it's heaped up with these carcasses that have come from slaying them with the jawbone. And then in verses 18 to 20, we see a whole different side of Samson than we've seen today. Now he's much more subdued. He's humble to some respects in that he's forced to acknowledge his dependence upon the Lord for real practical needs. He's come to a point where he's so physically exhausted, and he hasn't had nourishment, and he hasn't had anything to drink. He's famished. He's at the point of death, it seems. And he turns to the Lord now in verses 18 to 20. We're going to see the provision by God to sustain God's anointed deliverer. It reinforces this condition of humble dependence, that to show that that God is the source of life. God is the source of sustenance, of everything that he needs. He's not doing all this independently on his own strength, but it all derives from the life-giving power of God. So it says, then in verse 18, then he became very thirsty. You can imagine when it says that, he's very thirsty. This is a desperate situation. He calls to the Lord. When is he called to the Lord in what we've read so far? We haven't seen him in situations. He's calling to the Lord. He calls to the Lord. He said, thou hast given this great deliverance. He recognizes that it's God who's been at work behind the scenes. By the hand of thy servant, he recognizes his divine mission that he's been accomplishing, that he has a role to fulfill in the nation of Israel as their champion. And now he says, shall I die of thirst and fall into the hands of the uncircumcised? But God split the hollow place that is in Lehi so that water came out of it. And it reminds you of that scene back where Moses struck the water for the Israelites in the wilderness. That life-giving water came out, just as in the book of John, where it speaks of the Holy Spirit in terms of that life-giving water that sustains us, that gives spiritual strength to us, so that when we say, oh, I can't do it, these things are beyond me, this Christian life is too hard, I don't know what I've been called to, there's no way I can live this, we're taken back to God's provision, it's God's grace, it's the gift of the Holy Spirit that's at work within us, that should spring up within us as a fountain of water to give us revitalization, to give us strength. And so it says that God made this provision so that when he drank, his strength returned and he revived. Therefore, he named it Enhakkor, which is in Lehi to this day. So he judged Israel 20 years in the days of the Philistines. That name, Enhakkor, the spring of him who called. Recognizing the relationship between calling upon the Lord and the Lord's answer to our prayers and provisions that are sufficient to sustain us for all that we need. Jeremiah chapter 33, verse 3. Call to me, and I will answer you. I will tell you great and mighty things which you do not know. And in this sense, in this context here, I will provide for your physical needs, which are symbolic of your spiritual needs, of what you really need for spiritual life. And for sustenance. So there's several lessons for us in this account here in chapter 15. First of all, we're reminded of how violence breeds violence. You know, there's never an end to things. As you retaliate and you engage in this revenge type of tit-for-tat action, things always get worse and worse. We've been called to a different standard, to a different type of life where forgiveness and the grace of God is what we're to show to others. Of course, that has to do with personal relationships. Samson's in a different context here. He's in a national context where God is using him in warfare against God's enemies. And he's in a different situation than personal types of wrongs and injustices, even though he's responding, it seems, as if they are personal injustices in terms of how he's responding. So we're not to respond after this pattern of revenge and after saying, you did this to me, so I'm doing this to you. We're not to return evil for evil, and yet we see how God uses people for his providential plans and purposes. They want to see the strength of the Lord. But the strength of the Lord, that's what stands out to me in this chapter, the supernatural strength of the Lord. You had three different instances. You had the capturing of the foxes and setting them loose. That took the supernatural strength of God. You had that initial great slaughter where it doesn't say how many men he killed, and then you had the 1,000 men that he killed with the jawbone. Three different instances where the supernatural strength of the Lord was at work. So when it comes to fighting temptation for us, when it comes to being victorious in the Christian life, there shouldn't be any question that resurrection power of the Lord Jesus is what is available to us to work on our behalf. And then we're never to live as those sad Israelites lived. We're never to be comfortable. We're never to be complacent in being caught up in worldliness, in compromising a life of holiness, in giving in to sin and saying, well, that's just the way I am and I can't help myself. We're never to live that type of bondage. We're supposed to experience the freedom that God has called us to, and yet in the midst of experiencing that freedom, when the grace of God comes to us and grants us great victory and grants us deliverance, we have to maintain that humble dependence where we recognize that it's every provision of God that we count upon. It's nothing in ourselves, but it's looking and calling upon God day by day to give us this day our daily bread and to come and to sustain us in every day so that it's nothing of ourselves. This is, I think, the message from this chapter in Samson's life. Let's pray.